beyond speaking boundaries. My work is broadly framed by and builds upon the following sub-disciplines and theoretical approaches: more than human and animal geography, feminist SDS, emotional and affective geography, creative non-fiction, and intersections between post-humanism and a feminist ethic of care. My aim today, though, is not to peruse in theory, but to get stuck into one veterinary story about the emotional geographies of diagnosis in the small animal hospital. The small animal hospital was a key site within my research, a place associated with the wider vet school and open to the public. Clients, referred by their everyday vets, would take their pets there for specialist treatment, while student vets would work there in their final year as part of their clinical and professional education. This one story focuses on one dog called Tessa, one student called Natalie, and the more than human assemblages that produce immutable diagnosis. We begin in the office where students gather to complete all the necessary paperwork and also their coursework assignments. Natalie and I greet each other, fellow students in the small room offer their hellos. Natalie tells me she has a new case, beginning with a consultation at 10:30, and so reads up in the case history. It is Tessa, canine, a boxer dog with a sore back. Anna, another student, works on a history of another dog. I watch them scroll through the patient file on the computer, containing the details of all pre-existing consultations with the patient's usual first opinion vet. Natalie is time pressured as the client consultation where she will meet this dog and her owners is due to take place very soon. How does Natalie know what is relevant when she cannot possibly read or remember the whole history? For Foucault, continuity of description in medical histories is important. Quote, "Descriptive rigor will be the result of precision in the statement and in the regularity of the designation." But shortcuts can be helpful. Natalie and Anna tell me about some tricks they use when interpreting history. Think about how far back in history you should read and locate the body part in question. Natalie's case involves a sore back, so she looks for the earliest mention of anything to do with the back area, the word spinal, for example. It's then necessary to understand the symptoms of this body part. What is the nature of the symptom? When do the symptoms appear and disappear in the history? Has the first opinion vet done any diagnostic tests and then inferred a diagnosis? All this specific information has to be noted so Natalie prints off the history and highlights the essentials. She needs comfort of words and paper at this stage. To Natalie, though, in the office of the hospital, the animal patient is only a spectral representation of animal sentience, made up of sets of historical data with the name Tessa canine, neutered female. Whilst a set of relations now exists between Natalie and Tessa, there is no acknowledgement that Tessa is a living body which might impact upon the process of diagnosis. Natalie maintains power at this site, however inexperienced she might feel. Whilst empathy may occur between Natalie, Anna and I through the recognition of the stress of speed reading patient histories, empathy is not extended to nor generated from the animal in question. For the time being, it remains it, a disembodied case file and an object of verbal interpretation. Natalie then accesses another form of knowledge contained within her body, the deep anatomical knowledge she was taught in the lecture theatre. She thinks back to anatomy classes on the brain too and how that sticky grey matter might bear some resemblance to today's problems. Natalie asks, "Can you remember that class, Anna, the one about that thing?" "Oh yeah, I know what you mean," Anna replies. "I can't remember it though either. Want to look up online?" The precise name of the thing which Natalie and Anna try to remember here is not what I believe is most important about this exchange. Instead, it is the way in which they mobilise an idea to create an object, this thing which comes into play within their diagnostic practice. Recollective asides between colleagues are significant because they spark a collective memory about another time and place, causing an atmosphere or, as Kathleen Stewart puts it, a pocket to arise. Quote, "Looking for pockets is a labour of attending to a space opening out of the charged rhythms of the ordinary. There is a pause, a temporal suspension animated by the sense that something is coming into existence." Natalie does not have to worry about a final diagnosis at this early stage, but she must compose what is referred to as a differential diagnosis. Differential diagnosis is a logical technique used within veterinary medicine and human medicine to diagnose a problem in an individual. Goff in 2007 explains differential diagnosis as the approach underpinning problem-oriented medical management. A differential diagnosis is, simply put, a list of things that might be causing a specific problem. At this early stage, a differential diagnosis signifies the moment of learned imagination, which occurs before a final diagnosis and is mobilised by the question, given what we know up to now, what could be the final diagnosis, the actual cause of the problem? Differential diagnosis thus throws open a window of possibility, enabled by the vet's freedom of thought and informed speculation, before a more formal diagnosis is made. These diagnoses required being held up for inspection and passed around between everyone involved in a particular case, as we will see throughout Tessa's story. And so, having covered the discourse of the case history, Natalie and I move on to the distinctly body-focused aspect of clinical experience, where the multiplicity of multi-species medicine becomes at once clearer and messier, namely the consultation room. Natalie received some moral and technical support from Kath, the resident vet working on this case. I'm surprised with how casually Natalie accepts the responsibility of carrying out a consultation, and I wonder if she feels her chest pound slightly with fear and excitement. There is a thrill as we step across the boundary between the back of house and the reception where the clients sit. Natalie strides, smiles warmly, and calls out the client's name. Mr. and Mrs. Robertson? Handshakes are firm, and the relationship between the professional vet and client in need has begun. Natalie leads us to the consulting room. Inside, Mr. and Mrs. Robertson take a seat with shaky Tessa on a lead by their side. Natalie immediately gets to her knees to greet Tessa on her level. No longer is Tessa just a set of notes, but a very real individual. This act of dropping down to the same height as the dog is important, as Natalie and Tessa can correspond within the same body space. Tessa is terrified, though, and Natalie verbally acknowledges this, not that the dog will necessarily understand our words. Oh, Tessa, you poor thing, it's okay, she says to Tessa. Tessa continues to shake, but she leans into Natalie's hands as they stroke her forehead and sturdy body. There is a firmness to this touch which provides assurance to both Tessa and her owners, who relax their shoulders. It provides a release of tension, and Tessa concedes with a faint tail wag. Natalie knows what she is doing, and knows it is her job to manage the emotional geographies of the room. Natalie then assumes position behind the consulting table and in front of the computer. From here, she asks the clients for their story of events whilst highlighting what she knows already. So, Tessa's been having some trouble with her back, and you're here today to continue to find out what might be wrong. I can tell she's really suffering, so it's really important we get this sorted, she says. This acknowledgement of suffering, both of Tessa's pain and the client's frustration, is vital at this early stage. Like the comforting initial touches, it goes a long way in facilitating a caring atmosphere. Natalie then asks, can you tell me when all this started, in as much detail as possible? Mr. Robertson begins his story about when Tessa's problem began at home and how it affected their lives. Occasionally, Mrs. Robertson butts in to say something like, no, it was November, not December it happened, and together they piece together their understanding of Tessa's sore back. Natalie types this on her computer, but she cannot do it verbatim, of course, as it's all happening too fast. She has to seem interested not only in the facts of the story, evidenced by her writing things down, but has to show intrigue in the telling of the story. Yes, I see, says Natalie. This is a difficult job. Mr. Robertson then apologises. He's got something wrong, forgotten something, and has only just recalled it now. Mrs. Robertson confirms she also remembers a time when Tessa went over her legs in the park. Maybe this is relevant? The result is not a linear story, where pain has a distinct beginning and end. It is not told in a language of objectivism. Sometimes it even contradicts the initial history. Together, Natalie and the clients construct Tessa's history through their conversation to create a case file that is both quantitative and qualitative. The claim made by Goff that it is possible to know the patient fully or to completely understand all aspects of the disease through the process of diagnosis, though, cannot be true. The history taking and the initial encounter in the consulting room is always partial and flawed. Like Natalie and Anna's collective reimagining of the thing that might have been useful during the history reading, what factors come to be relevant come and go in the midst of the consultation. It is Natalie's job to make sense of these multiple overlapping lines of the story to create one history that can then be shared in the back of house, where the process of diagnosis can move on. The consulting room is thus a place of ongoing possibility, but also one with marked micro-geographies of anthropocentric power, geographies that are expressed and mediated through emotion, affect, and memory. Natalie's situating of her body behind the consulting table creates a boundary between herself and her clients, reinforcing her role as the expert who organises the story of Tessa. Natalie is the instigator of touch, and the encounter happens at her invitation. Despite Natalie's attempt to balance out power between her, Tessa, and the owners, it remains the case that the clients and the patient are in a diminished position through the tangible geographies of the room layout that enable a professional medical practice to take place. The next stage is when we take more of a focus on Tessa's body, having discussed her symptoms and history. Is this the time the body is meant to speak for itself? Natalie insists this body practice instigates this body practice by politely asking the clients for permission to take Tessa into the main area of the hospital. A lead is slipped over Tessa's neck. Goodbyes are whispered by her owners. Natalie and I take Tessa through the doors into the clinical atrium, the area located in the back of house of the hospital. Tessa's legs shake and she salivates profusely, a common sign of a dog's nervousness. The atrium is a very large open plan hall. Upon first inspection, the space is just a blur of off-white and varied shades of blue, a cacophony of syncopated beeps from machines competing for space and a general smell of sanitation. Tessa is led along one corridor and into a private room named Neurology Examination Room. Kath, the resident, Katie, one of the neurology specialists, and Anna also enter the room. Kath and Katie kneel on the floor, whilst Natalie, Anna, and I sit in the outlining chairs. It's a running joke in veterinary medicine that trousers do not last long for vets, as they're always on their knees getting close to their patients on the floor. Tessa shivers in the middle of the room and is free to roam in the room as she pleases, although she is reluctant to do so. Natalie tells me this free reign is deliberate, as it allows vets and students to see the patient in themselves, and this can be seen as a means of producing objectivity in the examination process. From this position, we can view the whole of Tessa's body, not just the centre of her suffering, her back. As if in deliberate contrast to this wide-angle view, Tessa still hovering awkwardly, Kath and Katie now approach Tessa and talk to her in a soothing voice. A tentative pat on the head by Katie is followed by a long stroke, to which Tessa responds with the slightest wag of her tail. However, this touching is also intended to make Tessa biddable and on the side of the vets, as the examination is long and uncomfortable. Formally, the neurological examination is characterised by a mapping of the body. Neurology relates to everything that's connected to the central and peripheral nervous system, situated in the brain and spinal cord. Hence why one can lose the feeling in one's leg when it was the spine or brain that was injured. All reflexes must be tested to find out where the bodily failure has taken place, or, in more technical terms, to localise the lesion in the nervous system. Knowing this, it's possible to then find the exact location in the body that's causing the problem. To begin the examination, Tessa is being made to lift up each leg in turn. Does it fall back to the ground to support her when Kath lets go? Yes. Then it's not this reflex that's problematic. A rubber hammer is brought out, and Kath gently taps it on Tessa's knee, and her foreleg flips forward involuntarily. The correct reflex response. "I'm so sorry, wee girl," Natalie says as she bends Tessa's paw back in itself to see if that response too is still working. Tessa's paw does its job and falls back into place. This continues until every part is checked and Natalie and Anna have had a chance to observe and practice the exam themselves. All the while, there are discussions about possible diagnoses. The body does not seem to speak for itself. To quote Foucault, "In this regular alternation between speech and gaze, the disease gradually reveals its truth, a truth that offers to the eye and ear, whose theme, although possessing only one sense, can be restored in its indubitable totality." "Could it be this issue in her hind leg?" asks Anna. "No, I think I know what it is. Let's just keep going with the examination for now. I think I know," replies Katie, the expert. This apprehensive knowing is Katie's veterinary experience at work. She does not assume she has seen it all before, but a productive tension has arisen between the actors in the room. It makes space for a learned subjectivity that emerges through years of repetitious, careful hand-eye interaction, but which only appears when the time is right. It is not formally replicable, but it is an essence of what it means to be a good vet. If one were to believe in a truly objective medicine, then this sense would not count for much alongside evidence-based medicine. Tessa is showing signs of what, in humans, we might characterise as petulance. We all know she is here because of pain and suffering, and the examination is now the cause of more of it. Her tail moves between her legs, and the palpations of her lower back done by Kate cause Tessa to expose her teeth in her snarl. Kath announces, "I can tell she's really hating this. She's holding her breath in pain. I think we should stop." Tessa's left to wander again, and the students and I observe Kath and Katie discuss the differential diagnosis. Their anatomical knowledge is astounding. I hear Natalie sigh in awe when they list off the names of the vertebrae, pointing out exactly where they are in Tessa's body. From the numerous potential diagnoses imagined by Natalie as she read the history, the vets and student vets have whittled it down to two, maybe even one diagnosis. We are all getting there, however, but Katie makes the one final statement, that the cause of pain is in Tessa's lumbar spine. The practices of veterinary diagnosis unfolding here encapsulate three central aspects about the More Than Human Veterinary Clinic. First, that the veterinary diagnosis and expertise is born out of More Than Human relations and is not just an objective and not just objective holism and application of logical deduction. Affective atmospheres are shown to be a key way of recognising and appreciating these tensions between human and animal, and certainty and uncertainty. The emotional geographies of diagnosis, after MOL, are made up of multiple sites, with each one configuring disease and expertise in a different way. Second, this case story demonstrates the range of roles taken on by non-human animals. Tessa the dog begins as a mere representation in the clinical history and emerges as a sentient and respected patient between the consultation. Although she, as a discursive object and as a vulnerable body, is an actor in each site encountered, it is only in the sites where she is physically present that she does demonstrate agency and resistance. Whilst it would be simple to say that Tessa is a medical object bent into uncomfortable positions by vets, students and clients, I've demonstrated how diagnostic practice takes Tessa's behavioural choices into consideration, and that veterinary practice is not all a matter of forcing non-human others into medical intervention. The humans in the story do not carry on regardless, but are always moving with Tessa. This starts off the discussion about the complicated tension between care and harm that runs through all stories of veterinary medicine. Lastly, by focusing on the multi-sided practices of diagnosis with Natalie and with Tessa, it has been possible to critically bring the animal into more than verbal conversations about their care, grasp the perspective of a student vet in clinical training, and unpick how students learn more about the hospital as a place of intersubjective multi-species education. What is of foremost importance here is the assemblage of the discursive, the visual, and the tactile to create patterns of movement and thought that, together, move towards a concept for a more than representational veterinary medical humanities. Whilst the traditional understanding of a Foucauldian clinic is evidently relevant, it is the ontological focus on a more than human geography of emotion, affect and atmosphere, which develops new vital insights into a multi-species veterinary medicine. Thank you very much.